Right, yeah, good afternoon. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving break. Yeah, just let me briefly just advertise once more that next semester there will be 502, which is a follow-up class. This will be more about structures, it also will be some aspects of counting, but we'll be looking at structures like graphs, codes, designs. We'll be looking at counting under symmetry. And otherwise, the class will follow roughly the similar pattern. There will be weekly homeworks with misprints. We'll fix them over the week, and then they are due. And yeah. Okay. Yeah, are there questions? No? You sounded, you looked as if you wanted to. You were just yawning because...
No, I'm not yawning. Yeah. We're good. Are we doing the RSK correspondence this week?
Yes.
Okay.
What?
RSK.
Robinson...
Schenstedt Knuth.
Okay.
Although Schenstedt by now wants... If you look up on his name on Wikipedia, Craig Schenstedt, you find that by now he changed his name first to Ea and then to Ea Ea.
What?
Yeah. This is an interesting area where some people go off the rails. Okay.
So I have a question.
Yeah. Yes.
On the final,
yes.
The one about the permutation of books.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding the increasing permutation or subsequence part.
Yeah.
So if you had five books and then you had 1, 2, 4, 3, 5.
So you have 1, 2, 4, 3, 5.
Right. So
yes.
You can move the 3 in front of the 4 and shift it down. So that should be one move, right?
Yes, yes,
okay.
That would be one taking one out and putting it in here, yes.
But then you want to say there's an increasing subsequence of length 4, if you can
yes,
move
1, 2, 4, 5.
Okay, so you can skip.
Yes,
okay,
yes, the increasings, yes.
Okay.
With the increasing subsequences, they do not need to be consecutive,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So I hope that fits. And the index, for once, the indices are not off by one. Other questions? No? So, good. Yeah, what we did before the break, we looked at several basis of the rings of symmetric polynomials, and we had, let me probably, since none of us in particular myself remembers what we did before, so we have the monomial symmetric functions, they are M lambda is the sum over all alpha, where alpha is a composition with the same parts of lambda, or if you want, these are permutations of lambda over x to the alpha, and with this notation, we just mean x1 to the alpha 1, x2 to the alpha 2. This multi-index notation is typically used when working with multivariate. Well, at least we're working with symmetric multivariate polynomials, and in some other contexts, it's just shorter to write. Well, then we have the elementary symmetric functions. And we define these in two parts. First, we define them for a number. We say EM is the sum over all the products of M indeterminates, so this is x1, x2, up to xm, plus, and now all permutations. of the indices. So I would have x1, x2, up to x minus 1, and x plus 1, and so forth. And then we define E lambda to be the product of E n1 times E n2, and so forth, up to E n k. And we have, well, we have a line free here. Lambda is n1, n2, up to n k. That's the partition. So here we don't allow duplicates. In the case of the completely homogeneous symmetric functions, we allow duplicates. So we say Hn is the sum over all lambda, which are partitions of n over m lambda, and we define h lambda is h n1 up to h n k. And finally we have the power sums. So the power sums are pm is x1 to the m plus and so forth plus x big M to the m, and p lambda is p n1 times and so forth up to p n k. So these are the power sum symmetric functions. And I didn't mention it because I wasn't here when it was covered, but you can look at it in two ways. You can look at it as more a linear algebra question than you really want the E lambdas and the H lambdas as vectors, or you could look at it as generating an algebra, and then you would typically have the ENs, HNs, PNs. And if you don't know what it is, don't worry about it. Okay, so, and we were in the process of showing that all of these span the ring of symmetric functions. So, what we did last time is we looked at generating functions. So, we defined E of t to be the sum over n greater or equal than 0, En t to the n, and we had seen this is equal to the product over R goes from 1 up to big N, 1 plus xR. And what we're doing here is this is just a formal power series and a formal variable t, and yes, the coefficients happen to be coefficients from the ring of symmetric functions, but there is nothing stopping us taking a polynomial ring over another ring. It's even all commutative. And we did the same for h of t. H of t was the sum over n greater or equal than 0 hn t to the n, and what we have seen is this is the product r goes from 1 to big N 1 minus xr of times t inverse. And that in some way, well, these expressions look rather similar, so there is some kind of duality between E, the E basis and the H basis, and we've seen this, for example, by the fact that there is a automorphism of the ring of symmetric functions which maps the En to Hn and vice versa. Okay, so now I want to do the power sums. And I think that's basically the place where we stopped before the break. Now the power sums. So let's take, we define P of t to be the sum over n greater or equal than 1. Why do I start at 1? Because P0 would be the sum of zeros powers and would be a constant. So I take the sum over n greater or equal than 1, Pn times t to the n minus 1. And now What do I want to show? I want to show the following proposition, which is number 531. If we take the derivative of h of t, derivative just in the formal power series sense, that is equal to p of t times h of t, and if we take the derivative of e of t, that will be p of minus t times e of t. And I will give you the proof of the first one. The second one basically follows exactly the same argument using the similarity here. Okay. So that's what I want to show. And basically, this is a practice exercise, another practice exercise in calculus. Two stuff without bothering about convergence. So P of t is, well, we have it there, the sum n greater or equal than 1, P n t to the n minus 1. And oh, here I have called it R. Well, that's easily fixed. P to the R minus 1. Okay. And now I want to express what this PR is. So I have the sum over R greater or equal than 1, sum over I goes from 1 up to big N, the number of variables. I have xi to the R, t to the R minus 1. Okay, and we have two sums. We change the summation. So if we change the summation order, we get the sum I goes from 1 to big N over a sum R go is greater or equal than 1, xi to the R times t to the R minus 1. And that is a geometric series. So from the geometric series formula, I get xi over 1 minus xi t. Okay. Is clear what I've done here, right? I've changed the summation order. I moved that R sum inside, and then it's easier to do it the other way around if you do the geometric series formula. You get this. Okay.
Is there an issue with starting the summation at 1 rather than 0 as the geometric series normally does?
No, because you have to shift your index by 1 anyway. You pull out one of the x y's and then you shift your index.
I mean, normally you would start at 0, so because I'm starting at 1, there is something I'm missing. And that just cleans out nicely to get me this.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm considering it, and I've just kept that step in 1 because we've done it so often. Try it out with a 0 and check what comes out, and if it doesn't work out the way it should, let me know and I'll fix this. Okay. So what is xi over 1 minus xi t? That's the derivative of a logarithm. So, I claim this is the same as, okay, and I'm pulling the derivative immediately out of the sum, ddt of the sum I goes from 1 up to n, logarithm, natural logarithm of 1 minus xit inverse. Okay. Why is this the case? Logarithm of 1 minus xit inverse, I can pull the minus 1 out, so it's the negative of the logarithm of 1 minus xit. Right? what's the derivative of the logarithm? It's the derivative with respect to t. Well, derivative is 1 over the argument times the inner derivative, and the inner derivative with respect to t would be minus xi, and that minus 1 kills that other minus 1. Okay? So it's just, if you don't need to prove convergence, calculus is easy. Yeah, so that gives us the gives us this expression. Okay. And now I claim, well, I have the sum over logarithms. Sum over logarithm is the logarithm of a product. That's what a logarithm does. So this is the same as dt of the logarithm of the product I goes from 1 to n 1 minus xi t inverse. And what is this? That is just h of t. So that is the t logarithm of h of t. Okay. And now the text says the result follows by logarithmic differentiation. Have you seen logarithmic differentiation? Some seem not so. What is the idea behind logarithmic differentiation? That's just in some way a trick to make arithmetic easier when differentiating. If you differentiate a product, the product rule makes out of one product two summons, both involving a product. So products blow up. So what does logarithmic differentiation do? Well, we don't even need to use it. What is the derivative of the logarithm? Well, ddt log of f of t, what is this? This is chain rule, outer derivative. So derivative of the logarithm is 1 over x, so I get 1 over f of t times inner derivative dt f of t. So what I get is, this is equal to 1 over h of t times dt h of t. And now I multiply with h of t, and the result is there. Okay. And if you do the same thing to get e here, basically you would want to take not p of t, but p of minus t, and you have somewhere a minus term, and that makes this minus xi a plus xi, and that minus 1 goes away, and then you get the same result for e. Okay, so why does this help us? So we can write this fact if we now look at a single power of t. We can write this in the following form. The equations n h n is the sum over r goes from 1 to n p r h n minus r. Right? That's the term you get in the derivative, and that's the product, the formula for the product of two power series, term in a product of two power series. And what this now allows us, and the indices are because I have that's what you get as a derivative here. And this n minus 1, that just makes the term come out that I need to start with r equals 1 here and not with r equals 0. So, what I can do is I can look at these equations as equations in the variables PR, and you get a nice upper or lower triangular system of equations. I want to consider the HI as variables. Yes, I can also consider the P's as variables, but that I can get the P's in terms of H's is trivial, because the H's span the ring of symmetric functions and the P's are obviously symmetric. I want to do it the other way around. I want to express the H's in terms of the P's. So the H's are the variables, and the p's are constants, and this is a system which is nicely triangular. So I can solve that system with, and because I have n here, I have non-zero coefficients on the diagonal. So I have a unique solution. In particular, I have a solution. I can express the h's in terms of the p's. So this is a system of linear equations. Equations express the HI in terms of the PI. So, because the HI span, therefore also the PI span. The only caveat is here you have not ones on the diagonal. So to express this, if you solve this, you will get denominators. So while the first three bases are bases that work over the integers, the p's will only work over the rationals over a suitable ring, because they will introduce denominators. Okay, so these are four basis of symmetric polynomials. In the notes, I have mentioned one other, but since I really just give the definition, I think I will skip over that bit. So there is another basis of symmetric functions. These are called Schur polynomials. And they are defined initially in a rather weird way. It's some horrible determinant, or you can define it in other ways, from partitions directly, and then it's also horrible. And it turns out these are really in the interesting basis if you want to use it, for example, for the character table of the symmetric group or so. But they are initially a little bit messy and come a little bit unmotivated if we don't do examples with them. So that's why I will skip that definition. Right, and that gets us to your question from the start, RSK. Unless there are questions. So, what I want to finish this course with is a process which in some way, it gives a combinatorial bijection, but it gives a bijection in a rather weird way. And in a way which one wouldn't really expect to happen. So, very roughly what we're doing, we're going to take some really goofy process of writing numbers down. This looks like something if you have kids in second grade and you want to occupy them, you tell them, show them some kind of hopscotch for numbers or so. And that process, against all expectations, turns out to do something meaningful. And this goes under the name of Robinson-Schenstedt-Knuth correspondence. Robinson is G.B. de Robinson, who, for example, also was responsible for the hook formula. Schenstedt, I mentioned already. He was a physicist, and Knuth is the Knuth who wrote LaTeX and wrote The Art of Computer Programming and so on. And I mean, the fact that you have some really clever people working on this indicates there is something behind. So, I will temporarily relax the definition of a tableau and will allow, well, one can relax it in many ways. There are situations where people allow to put numbers in multiple times or so. What I will want to temporarily allow is that I don't have the numbers 1 to n in there, but that I'm skipping numbers. But otherwise, I still want the rules increasing in the rows, increasing in the columns. And that's just so I don't need to define another term for objects which occur intermediately. Okay. And what I will start with is a process of taking a tableau in that sense and inserting a number in the tableau. Oh, and I should say this is now section. This is paragraph 7, Robbins and Schenstedt Knuth. Okay, so what we do is we take a tableau and we take a number and we want to insert that number in the tableau, and we want as a result again a tableau which has one more cell and has this number in. And it's probably easiest to see what it does by looking at it in an example. So I have
Are you counting in German?
Yes, because I can't count in English. No, it's just with things. If it's counting the number of steps in a tower when you walk up, or counting the number of sheets, this is easier in German.
Okay.
It's one of the few things where, I mean, with other things, I'm perfectly, well, I'm probably pronouncing it wrongly and make grammatical errors, but otherwise I'm perfectly happy with English. But with counting some things, that is still easier in English. So, and this is basically a random example to show sufficiently many things which are going to happen. Okay. And of course, what I'm going to do, which is slightly awkward, is I will write this down in steps. This is a step-by-step process, and I will erase numbers on the board and write other numbers down. Maybe I should, instead of erasing, write them down in another color, and then you can at least somehow follow what I'm doing. So I want to come with the number 8, and I want to insert the number 8 into that tableau. The way insertion works is we take the first row of the tableau and we want to insert the number 8 into that row. And what we're going to do is we look at the smallest number which is larger than 8. So that's the one which is, if we had 8 here, 8 would have to sit here. Okay. So, we take the smallest number which sits there where 8 is, we bump that number out. And yes, bumping is the technical term in this context. And we put 8 in there, so 8 is placed, but now we have 9 which needs to be placed. It could be that this number is larger than anything here. If it's larger, if there is no number larger, I just add the number at the end of the first row when I'm done. Anyhow, so in this case, what I did is I inserted the number in the first row and I bumped the number out. And what I'm now going to do is I look at the tableau I get from the second row and further. And I have the number 9, which I want to insert in the first row. So, I look at the smallest number larger than 9 in this row. Which one is it? 10. So 10 gets bumped out. Instead of the 10, I put the 9 in here, and I have a number 10. And the number 10 needs to be inserted into that row. Well, what is the smallest number larger than 10? That's 13. So 13 gets bumped, 10 gets put in, and I have 13 to be inserted into that row. What is the smallest number larger than 13 in that row? Well, there isn't one. So I add 13 at the end of that row. And I've obtained a new tableau, and that new tableau has also the number 8 in there. I say it is a new tableau. There is something which needs to be shown. Basically the tableau properties. So I need to check within the rows. It's pretty obvious what is happening, right? I'm taking a number out, which is just a bit larger than the number I'm putting in. But if I have different numbers, clearly here the 8 will be larger than 5 and smaller than 12. And that's how I found the one to bump out. So the rows are fine, but what I need to make sure is that if, say, two rows were the same length, that I can't add something and suddenly have a shape which is not a partition. And I need to make sure that within a column, within the columns, the numbers stay the same. So, that's what we need to show. And for that, we need to describe this process in a somewhat formal way.
Okay, now I think I want this here. Probably also start warming up that thing.
So, now the formal definition. I will consider a tableau in the same way as a matrix. So I have a tableau which has entries Tij. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to add further entries, fake entries, which are basically there to deal with borderline circumstances. So I'm going to put zeros along here, and I'm going to put infinities on the bottom and to the right. So I have T 0 I is 0, T I 0 is 0, and I have T I K is infinity if undefined before. Okay, and that is just because it will make the description of the algorithm slightly easier, in that I don't need to always have to say, oh, if I'm at the border, but a comparison argument will deal with it automatically. Okay, in particular, what this means is now this really is a proper matrix. Now Ti, it's even an infinite matrix. Tij is defined for arbitrary entries ij. Okay. So, I will also define a relation on the entries of T. On entries of T. Namely, I will say A is smaller or equal to B if and only if, and now come two cases, either I have A is smaller than B, or A is equal to B is equal to zero, or A equals B is infinity. And I have that every number, every proper integer is bigger than zero and is smaller than infinity. So I basically allow, with zeros, I allow them to be bigger than the next one, and infinities I allow to be bigger than the next one, because that's what I need here, that the tableau property is still satisfied. Right? Otherwise, I would need to have not zeros, but have 0, 0.1, 0.2, and so forth. Okay. So, with this, I want to characterize what is a tableau. And the characterization for the tableau is the following. Well, I have Tij is equal to zero if and only if I is equal to zero or j is equal to zero. Right? That's the only places where I'm allowing zeros. I'm allowing them here in this top and left fake extra row. Okay. And then I have that Tij Tij is in this order smaller or equal than Tij plus 1, and Tij in this order is smaller or equal than Ti plus 1 j, and this holds for all I, j greater than 0. That's just saying I want that in the rows and in the columns numbers get strictly larger. Get larger with respect to this ordering. Yeah. Okay. And I will write X is not contained in T if X is infinity, or X is not equal to Tij for all as ij. So infinity is never in, and otherwise it's the numbers which occur. Okay, and now I want to look at the insertion algorithm.
Oh, that was on purpose.
Sorry?
We were all wondering if you meant to.
Yeah. Oh, this is on purpose. Of course, this is on purpose. So I want
why project from your phone instead of your iPad?
So that I can hold something in the, well, A, because I brought that adapter and not the other one. That's the plain stupid answer. The more sophisticated answer is because that way I can look at I can hold it still in the hand and can, on the other hand, do the. So where, what page am I here? On page 85. Oh, thank you very much. So, okay.
You should leave it on for
I'm not going to make it if you don't. Or at least this one. I mean, you can turn them off.
You anyhow can't see from that angle.
Well, I can totally see.
You can totally see. Okay.
We're okay.
So, what this is a formal description of the insertion algorithm. And what I'm going to do is I will try to briefly go through and explain what is happens and explain why this preserves a tableau, but I'm not going to go in gory detail about how this algorithm works. So what I'm going to do is, so I have this tableau, I have a number which is not yet in the tableau which I want to insert, and I want to create a new tableau, and this new tableau will have X in, and it will add a cell in a particular position. So my output is the new tableau and also the position where this new cell was placed. Right here, this was the new cell. Okay, so how am I going to do it? I'm going to look at the first row. I will produce a sequence of the XIs, which are the numbers one by one, how I inserted them, because later on that sequence will be of interest. And I will go in the first row and I look, J is the smallest index so that Tij is infinity. So I'm going to the end of the first row. Okay. So now I want to find which element do I want to bump out. So what I will have at this point is always that Xi will be smaller than Tij, well, smaller than the entry where I am, and will be larger than the entry in the row above. Well, at the start I don't have it. So this is just a condition I need to preserve. And what I'm going to do is, if Xi is smaller also than the previous entry, I go back in that row. So I decrease J until I can't. If I can't, I have found the smallest number larger than X. And I store that number and I remember where in which column I am. So what I'm now going to do is I bump out X, this entry here, the entry Tij. I'm going to bump out. Namely, I set it to the variable xi plus 1. That's the next number I need to insert. I put the xi, which was the x I currently need to work on, into the position. And now I claim what I have at this point is that xi is strictly smaller than xi plus 1. Why that? Because that was how I got xi plus 1. It was a number larger than xi. This entry is smaller than xi. Again, that's because otherwise I would have gone furthermore back in the row. And I have that this was the entry tij, and yeah, that entry is smaller than the next entry because the row of the tableau goes on. What I claim is that xi will be larger than the entry I have above. So let's look at this situation. That's probably easier to see if I go to the situation where I'm inserting in the second row. So I have the 9, which I'm inserting here. I went back to the 10. So I put the 9 in. What I'm claiming is this 9 is larger than this 5, right? I'm in column J. This is larger than the entry in the row Ti minus 1 J. Well, this xi is still smaller than xij. That's still the same inequality.
So, why is that the case?
Oh, that's okay. So, why is this the case that the XI must be larger than the entry above? Because if that entry was larger than this one, the number previously, this number got bumped out, right? So I have XI when it comes in, and I have a J where I'm coming in. The XI needs to be larger than the number which was in the, right? Now here I would have the 9. The 9 needs to be larger than the 8 because the 8 bumped out the 9. That's why it is larger. Larger than this and therefore also larger than all before. So what this bumping process does, it takes a number, I'm going down in the next row and I'm going, I can't be further to the right. I can be only in the same position or more before. I need to go left. And that ensures the column property. Right. Now I want to check, am I done? If the element I bumped out actually is an infinity, that could have happened, then I've added the number at the end of a row and I'm done. Then there is nothing to be bumped out to insert. So I'm checking this. If this is not the case, if it's not infinity, then I'm going in the next row with this next value of x and go back in here and do again the insertion. And otherwise, I return the place where I edit the cell and end the algorithm. So, because of that property, which here is somewhat awkwardly encoded in these inequalities, because I'm going always to the left, also the column property is satisfied. Right, so what this process therefore does is it guarantees that a tableau is returned. Okay. Right. So what this algorithm does is it returns a bumping sequence I start with x, which was x1, that is smaller than x2, is smaller than x3, right? The numbers I'm bumping out have to get larger and larger until I get xs plus 1. And xs plus 1 would be infinity. That's the last number I'm bumping out where I'm not processing. And I get column indices R1 greater or equal than R2 and so forth up to RS, which is T. That's the columns where I'm inserting, and they get smaller. Okay. So, and that's a good place when to stop. So we have seen how to insert a number into a tableau. What we are going to do as the next step is we are also going to build a second tableau, which essentially encodes where we add the new cells. And we will, for a permutation, get 2 tableaus. And the miraculous thing is that is bijection. this is not obvious. No. It has no reason to be a bijection.
That's good.
No, this is a really weird property that it is a bijection. Anyhow, thank you very much, and I see you on Wednesday.